Thanks very much. And when one has the effrontery to talk about a very topical question, there is always the risk of being overtaken by events. And I'm particularly aware of that, given what happened at about 3 o'clock this morning. So I make my remarks with a certain amount of disquiet. But I thought it would be appropriate to speak to the document that was produced a few weeks ago entitled The National Security Strategy of the United States, and to try to find, I am after all an economist, and finding logic in things is sort of a professional deformation, but to try and find an underlying logic in those, in this official document. The document, by its own terms, seeks strategic stability with Russia. It declares that China is merely a competitor, that the Middle East is not central to American security, that Latin America is, quote, our hemisphere, and that Europe faces, quote, civilizational erasure, whatever that means. It does bring to mind Gandhi's great remark that Western civilization would be a good idea. India, the world's largest country by population, barely rates a mention. One might say, as Neville Chamberlain did at of Czechoslovakia in 1938, quote, a faraway country of which we know nothing. Well, so much the better for India, which can take care of itself. The realpolitik of the document is breathtaking, yet the underlying logic is not stated. Indeed, as a statement of political ideology or values, the strategy is incoherent. It declares respect for the sovereignty of countries whose governing systems differ from ours, but then berates Europe for anti-democratic practices, again, not to mention what happened this morning. It admits the end of U.S. hegemony and then asserts possession of the whole Western Hemisphere, citing the Monroe Doctrine as though it were Hurley Writ. Is there an Ariadne's thread that ties all of this together? I think there is, and it is a logic of resources, and in the first instance of fossil fuels. With oil flowing thick and fast from Texas and reserves in Canada and Venezuela, the U.S. could, in principle, exit the Persian Gulf. It could even, in principle, I'm not predicting that it will happen in practice, leave Israel to its own devices. Russian gas, more precisely the lack of it, has sealed the fate of Europe. Germany is deindustrializing, while Britain and France, their empires long gone, are in deep and continuing decline. Sanctions having failed, Russia's eventual victory in Ukraine is assured, and it was sanctions and not military action that was supposed to turn the trick on Russia. It is necessary to accommodate Russia, and if necessary, which it apparently is, to break America's longstanding ties to the Russophobic European elites. It is a simple fact that where there is affordable and abundant energy, business prospects are better. With China, the resource issue is rare earths, and especially gallium, which is not a rare earth, but a byproduct of refining bauxite into aluminum. China controls rare earths through a near monopoly on refining, which could erode with determined effort over time. Gallium is different. Gallium, as I said, is a byproduct of aluminum. U.S. aluminum capacity peaked in 1980 at a finished product capacity of about 5 million metric tons, which would translate into maybe 8 or 9 in the production of aluminum. Not coincidentally, this was just as the Federal Reserve under Paul Volcker launched its great crusade against inflation, against trade unions, with American industry as collateral damage. The Chinese advantage in the underlying refining is now 90 million metric tons to 1 million metric tons. Mm. The U.S. cannot own source gallium in adequate quantities on any timescale. As there is no substitute for gallium in advanced microchips necessary for the military sector, for advanced processors, The U.S. military cannot now confront China and prevail. Détente is therefore necessary for America, as it is desired and accepted by China. The remarkable softening of the Trump line toward China is the direct consequence of this reality, likely conveyed to the administration by its contractors. Then there is the contrasting notion that the nations of Latin America are not really countries, but dependencies and satrapies, colonies in all but name, run by caciques. There have been and still are such countries in the region, cannot be denied, but Mexico and Brazil, not to mention Colombia and Venezuela until this morning, not to mention Nicaragua and Cuba, have other ideas. The brazen Miami mobster tone of this document is scarcely removed from the years before the American Civil War, when Cuba and Mexico were seen as the new frontiers for Southern slaveholders. The new frontier is, of course, oil. As a strategy, this is not an ironclad document. So far, it has not perceptibly affected Pentagon planning, and it should not be taken too seriously until bases are closed, aircraft carriers decommissioned, and nuclear weapons mothballed while a new Navy comes into being. It is also hedged in several unrealistic ways, such as the notion, quickly quashed by China, that perhaps Japan and Korea might defend the so-called First Island Chain, a euphemism for Taiwan. Especially unrealistic is the idea that Europe will step up on self-defense with triple or more of the present military spending while their economies continue to decline. It is mathematically possible that Europe could reach the 5% GDP target by depressing its GDP levels, but I think that's also somewhat improbable. And for all the bluster and buildup and the, well, I skipped the sentence about the side of the administration that so far restricted itself to piracy. That one is out of date at the moment. As domestic economics, the new strategy is a mass of contradictions. It seeks reindustrialization while simultaneously protecting the financial system and the global dollar. It seeks technological leadership while cutting taxes, regulation, and the government's long degraded ability to specify what leadership entails. It wants to build up an invincible full-spectrum military while promoting pro-worker, quote, prosperity that is widely shared. This is the syndrome of the child that wants every shiny package under the tree, and one may well expect a tantrum when the reality dawns that you can't have it all. Still, for all its defects, as an assault on the previously sacrosanct Eurocentric unipolar world order, the new strategy is something of an icebreaker. It recognizes the shift in the center of gravity of world power that has already occurred. It states openly that the United States cannot dominate the real existing world in defiance of what has been a sacred political, military, and economic scripture since the fall of the USSR. A country that cannot dominate the world also cannot impose its supposed values on that world, but must accept the other great powers as they are. I'm not going to get too optimistic that this will in fact occur. History teaches that caution is in order. The forces of a declining world power are dangerous, often delusional, and for this reason, the previous efforts at peacemaking, Kennedy's with Khrushchev, Nixon's with China, with Mao, Kennedy, Reagan with Gorbachev, eventually came to naught. But the situation today is a little different in the sense that the material advantages in each of those episodes of the United States were stronger than they are now. And it's also its need to dominate the world was actually greater than is true today. The U.S. held an overwhelming strategic superiority over the Soviets in the 1960s. And while the stalemate in Korea was a straw in the wind and the defeat in Vietnam an embarrassment, even in the 1990s, U.S. power could be deployed to the Persian Gulf for quick and apparent easy victories. But since then, American military capacity has eroded. Russia has strategic parity, China has the deterrence it finds necessary, and in conventional warfare, an era of missiles and drones has been has superseded that of air carriers and bases, and the technological conditions of conflict now overwhelmingly favor the defensive. The most powerful naval forces must be kept safely far from danger, as the Houthis have demonstrated in and around the Red Sea. The material conditions, in short, favor peace. It helps that neither of the other great powers, let alone the almost unmentioned India, has delusions of world domination. Taking the world situation as it is, the U.S. can find common ground with Russia, can live with China as a co-equal and a trading partner. And this would leave, if it became accepted and practical doctrine, the United States with the obvious and great challenge, that of reconstructing the American economy and national attitudes in line with global realities. And here again, one cannot be optimistic. Big finance in the military-industrial complex, including the information surveillance technology sector, are at the center of domestic power. Russophobia, Sinophobia have been their ideological bread and butter since the forever wars began to lose their political appeal. And the vast American service worker class, to whom neither Russians nor Chinese seem much of a threat, is on the periphery of that power. Adjusting our economy to achieve pro-worker prosperity is a task that lies ahead. It will not be simple, it will not be free of internal conflict, it will obviously not be achieved by the powers that be in the present administration any more than it was achieved by previous administrations, but that seems to me to be the task that should be in front of all of us for the period to come. Thank you very much.